Kia ora, and welcome to Amran's Podcast, episode 217. Today is Tuesday, May 25, 2010. You'll have noticed that I've started saying what day I'm recording again, and that's for my benefit, mostly, also to reduce some confusion, although, if I was really serious about avoiding confusion, I'd be more careful about how I name my podcast episodes. The previous episode, episode 216, Recovery Mode, has the exact same name as episode 193. Oh well, too late now. But, yes, so I am, again, saying the date, and I'll actually talk a bit about that later as well. I am, because I'm sure your most concern is with my health, I am doing better. I'm still a bit croaky for some reason, but it'll eventually pass. It's probably the change of season and the generally wet, damp weather we've been having lately. I don't know. But anyway. Well, today I'm going to tell you about a topic that came up on the last Archer Radio Group Archer Group show that I was on, which was episode 1067. And it was a relatively small topic that we addressed in passing, but it does, I think, show some of the ways that Australia and New Zealand are quite different from the U.S. And it's some background is provided by a listener to that, and I will share that shortly. But first, there's a new report that says that petrol in New Zealand is the fourth cheapest among the OECD countries. OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is basically the richest nations in the world, the developed countries. And New Zealand was fourth. Now, according to the New Zealand Herald, the Ministry of Economic Development took data from the International Energy Association and, after removing government taxes, found that in the December quarter of 2009, the cheapest petrol price in the world was the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, and then, of course, New Zealand. And what U.S., Mexico, and Canada have in common is that they have their taxes make up the smallest portion of the pump price. So at that time, petrol in the U.S. and Mexico was about $1 a liter. It was about $1.40 a liter in Canada and above $1.70 per liter in New Zealand, and slightly more again in Australia. Now, of course, that doesn't really tell you much because all of that is in New Zealand dollars, and of course, it's metric. So for the benefit of my American friends, I did the conversion for you, and $1.70 New Zealand dollars per liter works out to roughly, today, it works out to roughly $4.34 U.S. per U.S. gallon. So roughly, at that time, we were paying $4.34 per gallon for petrol, and a huge chunk of that is, or was, taxes. Now, onto the topic that we were talking about on the Archer Group show, which is at archer.com, by the way. And I'll put a link in the show notes, too. It came up briefly. We were talking about an Australian politician who had been filmed, and, well, he had been filmed coming out of a gay club and had resigned. That was basically all we talked about on the Archer show. It had been referred to on Joe My God for sure, and I think some other places as well, as that it was a fall of a family values politician. And the assumption among a lot of Americans is that it's exactly the same as it would be in America. That if he's a family values politician, he must be, you know, some sort of bad person. Well, it's not quite that simple. And to illustrate that point, I received an email from a listener. And since I didn't give permission to say his name, I will just say it's from R, not that it matters. But he was commenting on this, and he said that, I know you only just touched on the scandal over here in Australia with one of our senior New South Wales politicians being caught leaving a gay sex on-premises venue, but it really brings home the difference between the U.S. and Australia and New Zealand. Now, before I go on, remember, of course, that Australia is a federation, and that it has separate states, one of which is New South Wales. The capital of New South Wales is Sydney. And also, that briefly touched on another difference between Australia and Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, and that is that we do have sex on site clubs in these countries where people can go and have an entertaining time with someone. Generally speaking, it's of the same sex, although I believe we have opposite sex ones as well. I don't know. And that's quite different from the U.S., where such things exist, but they're very clandestine and hidden. And they're not clandestine here. And also prostitution, of course, is legal in New Zealand. But I digress. Now back to the email. He goes on. First, some background on the state of things in New South Wales. The current Labour, left of centre, government, has been in power now for something like 16 years, and the last 5 to 6 years has been plagued by so many scandals and incompetence, if not out-and-out corruption, that the leadership of the party and cabinet has been completely changed 3 times in this period. Unfortunately, with the Liberal, right, and with their own problems, it has been a case of better the devil you know. And now, another digression. One of the things that you do need to understand about Australia is that the Liberal Party in Australia is liberal in the 19th century sense of the word. Some people would call them neoliberal, which in American phraseology would be neoconservative. It gets very confusing. But the Liberal Party is in the federal government is in coalition with the National Party, which is a largely rural party, and they form the coalition. And John Howard, the ex-Prime Minister of Australia, was the leader of the Liberal Party in the federal parliament and was the leader of this coalition. So, but both the two main parties, the Liberal Party and the Labour Party, both have state affiliates. And in New South Wales, the Labour Party currently is running the state government. The head of the state government is called a premier, whereas the head of the national government is called the prime minister. But in a lot of ways, they're actually very similar. And each state has its own governor, as Australia also has a governor general. So, you following me so far? I hope so. So anyway, he goes on. David Campbell, the minister involved, has overseen some of the biggest stuff-ups and money-wasting in the transport portfolio he looks after, including a crash on the main freeway leading north from Sydney that left commuters trapped in the road for up to 12 hours. Even though the government had just completed a $28 million contraflow traffic management plan to be used in such a situation, this was not implemented until 11 hours after the initial crash. What happened basically is that there's a crash involving a truck, and the traffic was all backed up, and people were trapped in their cars. And what they're supposed to do is to have a plan to get traffic diverted around it, sometimes going on the other side of the road, which is, I believe that's where contra comes from. That would in New Zealand, I presume it's true in Australia. And so they can get around the wreck and keep on going. Well, this didn't happen. And the Liberal opposition in New South Wales has argued that the minister was completely unavailable on that date. However, he has apparently is producing phone records to prove that he was in his office when this was all going on. So I don't know what the story is there. I don't know what the truth is. But anyway, he goes on. On last Thursday, he was spectacularly outed by Channel 7, one of our main TV news services. He was forewarned and tendered his resignation at 5:30 p.m., just half an hour before the story aired. The interesting thing from this story has been the fallout. While there have been some people agreeing with what the reporters and Channel 7 News did, the vast majority of the population have been absolutely disgusted with how he has been treated and believe as long as what he did in his private life does not affect his public duties, it is his business. Polls are running about 75% saying he had no need to resign from his position in the ministry. And me again. And I have read some articles, including some links that that are provided. And that's absolutely true. The reaction has, in most cases, been overwhelmingly against Channel 7 rather than against the minister. There have been some people who obviously speak out. But there was a particularly interesting thing on the ABC, Australian ABC website, where a woman was taking to task those who were criticizing him, including a gay radio host in Sydney, I believe it was, who was saying some things that were a bit unfortunate. And if I remember, I'll put a link to that in the show notes, because it's definitely worth a read. He goes on. David is getting the full support of the gay community and has been supported by his colleagues and members of the opposition party. Even the premier, who is supporting him, has apologized for the wording in some of her statements on the issue. This is the initial statement sounded not exactly homophobic to me, but kind of borderline. However, I actually have a sound clip of what she has said since then, and I will play that now.
Let's just all have a deep breath and understand what has happened here. A man who's been living with a secret about his sexuality for over 2 decades has had it come out, not in a manner of his choosing, and certainly in a way that is most devastating for his family.
That was New South Wales Premier Christina Keneally, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, commenting there. And continuing on with the email, he says, some have complained that he's hypocritic for running for his seat on family values, in quote marks. But as some of the media have pointed out, he has been a dedicated father and husband for 33 years. Religion is not as intertwined in politics over here, and family values is the big catch cry and de facto religious right platform. If you don't campaign on family values, you have very little chance of being elected. Interesting that he is being branded as a hypocrite for campaigning on family values, but our Deputy Prime Minister, who is a single spinster who has no interest in having a family, is able to run with little or no comment. And actually, I have a comment from her as well.
There's a line here about media coverage. It's always a difficult line to pick. But with this example, with the New South Wales Transport Minister, I think probably what we're seeing now is a family under some real pressure.
That was the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard, and also speaking on the same issue was the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Liberal National Coalition, Tony Abbott, who said this.
Focus should be on the minister's or the former minister's record, on the failures of the New South Wales Labor government. As for the rest, it really is a personal matter, and I feel very sorry for his family.
Now, while Tony Abbott was trying to score political points there, obviously, I still can't imagine any Republican leader in the U.S. saying anything remotely similar if there was a similar situation that occurred in the U.S. But our goes on in the email. The other thing with David Campbell is that unlike the trail of disgraced U.S. Republican senator and congressman caught up in this type of scandal, he has been a very active supporter of gay issues and was instrumental in having the age of consent in New South Wales for gay men lowered to 16 to bring it in line with the heterosexual age of consent. He also voted in a vote to introduce same-sex partnership registration in New South Wales to improve legal rights of same-sex couples in the state and as the first step toward same-sex marriage. While the story was big news on Friday and had many editorials over the weekend, there was very little today, Monday. The media has basically left him alone to work out his issues, and he is expected back in Parliament in just over a week's time. While he has resigned from his senior minister position, he will remain the member for his seat and will more than likely run again in the election in March next year. He is in a very safe seat and should be easily re-elected. And thank you for that email and also for all of that background information, and all of which is very true. And I think it just, again, underscores one of the huge differences between this part of the world and the U.S., that, first of all, religion isn't as much of a focus as it is in the U.S., and in particular, that it isn't a focus of politics in this part of the world either. As much as John Howard would sometimes pander to the far-right Christians, he himself was not particularly, he didn't try to be a fundamentalist Christian in the same sense as George Bush. I mean, sure, he called himself George Bush's deputy sheriff, and many of his tactics were borrowed from Karl Rove. Nevertheless, he wasn't a Bushian type of critter. And, of course, we don't have anything remotely similar to that here in New Zealand. Now, a few episodes back, 201, I think it was, I talked about religion in New Zealand, taking as the starting point a fundamentalist church here and in Australia that was in the news for malfeasance and so on. And I talked about the role of religion in New Zealand generally, or more specifically, the percentages of New Zealanders who consider themselves to be a part of a religion. And the trend in New Zealand overall is for religion to decline and for non-affiliation to increase, which is not to say necessarily that it's more than a third now of the population is atheist or agnostic even, just that they have no religious affiliation. They may, in fact, be very religious, all things considered. But the census figures can't tell us that either way. But it can tell us that they don't identify with a particular religion. And if they don't identify with any religion, the chances of them being, well, for lack of a better word, brainwashed into fundamentalism are considerably more remote. And so this is a good thing. Now, we were also talking a bit on the Archer Show about the way people are treated in the workplace and so on. And I said something on that show which was a bit misleading. I said that that there is a religious component in the workplace in New Zealand. And I didn't get a chance to elaborate on that. And I didn't mean that quite the way that probably sounded. What is common is that there will be a religious component for things like the opening of a new building, where there's usually a karakia, which is a Maori prayer. It's part of a ceremony, a blessing, which is always Christian in nature. And of course, that also happens at public events and even at schools and so on. But I didn't mean to create the impression that people are overtly religious in the workplace, because that's certainly not true. I can't remember ever hearing somebody talk specifically about their church or about religion or about anything remotely similar to the two. I've never seen anybody try to offer a prayer at work. That's much more likely to happen, ironically enough, in the public sector, you know, government things, where in addition to things like karakia, there might be a blessing before a meal or something like that. Again, it has more to do with cultural sensitivities than it does with actual overt religiosity. Having said that, though, it still is pretty unusual to see people being publicly religious in New Zealand, apart from a specific cultural context. And it was one thing I should have made clearer on Archer's show, but we got talking about other things and I never got back to it. Again, this whole topic of religion in the public sphere, I think, not just in government, but also in society in general, is one of the biggest ways in which New Zealand and Australia are both very different from the U.S. And sometimes it's something that I take for granted. I'm so used to not seeing overtly religious things that it always jars me when I do. And a case in point, a week or so ago, there was a letter to the paper, and it was actually following up on a follow-up to a letter of somebody complaining about, God, this is complicated, a women's center here in North Shore City in Auckland. They didn't, for whatever reason, they didn't like what this women's center was doing, their programs. And this person wrote a letter saying that it was anti-Christian and anti-family values. And of course, long-time listeners of this podcast, readers of my blog, will know how that got under my skin, because there's no such thing as one kind of family values. There is conservative family values, there's liberal family values. It's a continuum, just like political values. And she didn't mean it that way. And also to suggest that something that she doesn't agree with is anti-Christian is just absolutely absurd. Because, again, they're liberal Christians as well as conservative Christians, and she has no right to claim that phrase only for herself. And that letter really jarred me because I wasn't expecting it. From my perspective, it came out of the blue. Now, we do sometimes see letters like that in our local paper because we have a fairly large South African immigrant community who are very often of the more fundamentalist religious types. And we also have people from other countries who may or may not be, who are fundamentalists. So we may see that more in our local paper than you would ever see in a major daily like the New Zealand Herald or the Dominion Post or the Christchurch Press or whatever. And that's just the way it is. Where you get pockets of immigrants who think alike, then you tend to, I don't know if you can hear that, but it's pouring down rain right now. Anyway, now I forget what I was saying. Maybe it's God judging me. Who knows? I shouldn't say stuff like that, but anyway, actually, we just had a scare over the weekend where there was supposed to be a weather bomb descending Sunday night, and they were warning about gale force winds and heavy rains and stuff. Well, we didn't end up getting much of anything here in Auckland, although the rest of the country is still suffering because of apparently because of a low that is lingering. But it's right now raining harder than it did most of Sunday night and Monday, which is kind of odd, really, when you think about it, because the storm center has already passed beyond Auckland. But with that digression aside, or maybe because of the digression, I'm going to move on now to comments. And starting at first is a phone message.
Hi, Arthur. This is Tyrone in beautiful downtown Columbus, Ohio. I discovered your podcast when I was doing research. Hopefully I'll be in New Zealand in September, and really hopefully I'll be staying for quite a while. So I was doing some research on expat issues, and your podcast is fantastic. It is one of the best resources I found. So thank you so much and keep up the good work. Bye.
Well, thank you for that, Tyrone. And I've actually been to Columbus, Ohio. I once spoke at a rally there, which I prefer not to remember because I didn't do very well. Anyway, that was a whole lifetime ago. And again, thank you. And this is a good time to remind anyone who cares to do so, that I'm always more than willing to take up topics that people suggest, things they want to know about that they're interested in, and so on. By all means, feel free to ask. If I don't know the answer, I may be able to point you in the direction anyway. I often do research, as I did with the organ donation question some time back. And the only thing I don't comment on directly is specific immigration advice, because that would be illegal. Immigration advisors need to be licensed, and it's just too risky to even offer oblique immigration advice. But apart from that, you know, anything's fair game, really. And as I said, if I don't know the answer, I can probably point you in the direction of those who do, or find out, as the case may be. I have many topics that I've got, I was going to say irons in the fire or whatever, that I'm still working on or researching or whatever, and they'll eventually be on the podcast as well, along with more guests, hopefully, but that's a very difficult thing to arrange for a whole variety of reasons. But I'm still working on that. But again, thank you, Tyrone, and thank you for keeping the phone line open for another 30 days. Until the next person calls, who will that be? I don't know, but we won't know today. But now I'm going to go over to the written comments, and that this, of course, is over at aaronspodcast.com. And the first comment was from Tim Carmel, who said, "Glad you're feeling better. I'm looking so forward to the Pride 48 weekend." Thank you, Tim, and I am looking forward to that as well. One thing I forgot to say about Tim last time, I was talking about his ending his Go Rainbow Radio podcast. I forgot to mention that he provided invaluable advice to me when I interviewed Monique Rhodes many episodes back. And he basically gave me suggestions on how to go about, you know, structuring the interview or whatever. And I followed his advice, and I thought it worked really well. Now, mind you, that podcast was released when I was doing the transition from Podomatic to my own site, and it didn't get the downloads it perhaps could have, but nevertheless, I certainly valued Tim's suggestions and support, so that was very good. And next up was Archer, who said, "Yay, you're feeling better. Thanks for joining my show last night. It's always fun. Now, as to not saying the date, how will I know what date it is if you don't say it? I guess I'll have to go by the date you post it." And, of course, Archer, I have changed my mind about that and have started saying the date I'm recording back on the podcast. And, of course, the date I'm recording is the date when most people in the Americas will be hearing it, probably, because we're a day ahead. But anyway, it's just that whole time relativity thing just gets so confusing. And finally was Roger Green, who said, "You inspired a blog post. Expected Thursday a.m. U.S. time." I'm like, oh, I wonder if I should be worried. You can visit Roger's blog at rogerogreen.com. There is a link on my podcast site and on my blog under Bevy of Blogs. He goes on, "Love to see a link to the New Zealand census questions and a discussion of the types of questions asked, or not, on the different forms. For the U.S. example, you might consider the 2000 long form or the American Community Survey form, since the 2010 form is so short. I've been fascinated by the fact that the Canadians allow for a question on religion in their census, while in the U.S. it would be anathema to many folks, separation of church and state and all that. Oh, re your previous show, I forgot to write about Twinkies. I was boycotting Twinkies in the early 1970s. They were made by ITT at the time, and ITT at the time was part of the Vietnam War machine. So when the war was over, I tried a Twinkie, which I recall not liking a lot before. Not so good." Thank you for that, Roger. And actually, I did find a discussion document or whatever on the Statistics New Zealand website where they talk about the 2010 census. The thing I mentioned about the gender isn't mentioned on there at all in terms of discussion topics, but there is a discussion about how they are asking specific questions about civil unions this time, because apparently they felt that the data from the 2006 census wasn't usable or reliable. And I'm not entirely sure why. They didn't elaborate. 2006 would have been the first census after civil unions became law, and of course now we're getting further down the track. So that was the only major difference I noticed. We do ask about religion on the New Zealand census as well, obviously, because I was talking about it a bit today and also in the on episode 201. And it really provides fascinating demographic data to see how things change over time. The census forms themselves are stored securely for 100 years, and after that they may be made available for statistical research. But even then, the research has to be approved by the government statistician and meet confidentiality requirements of the Statistics Act of 1975. The point of all of that, of course, is that privacy is respected by law in New Zealand. We have a national privacy law, which, of course, the U.S. doesn't have. And in the case of collecting statistical data, everyone has to be told that it's being collected. They have to be told what purpose it's for, and that information cannot be used for any other purpose than the purpose for which it was gathered. And that's true for any government agency or private business. A private business can't get your information to ship you products and then use that to sell you something from an affiliated company, for instance. That would be illegal. And similarly, somebody can't collect data to sell you something and then use it to try to get your credit information. They can't do that without your specific permission. A credit agency cannot turn over their information to any third party without your specific authorization. There are a couple of exceptions to these things here and there. And in the case of the census, they have specific law governing how they do things, which in some cases may be slightly different from the way other government agencies, let alone businesses, can do things. But it's all really quite well regulated and quite strongly regulated. Every man, woman, and child in New Zealand must have a form completed for them on census night, which is one night. I don't remember what it is exactly. Maybe it's changed. I don't know. And it is a criminal penalty to deliberately avoid filling out the census. Now, every year, every census, there are some people who deliberately leave the country to try to avoid taking part in a census. They may go to Australia. One year, I remember somebody was in a hot air balloon above New Zealand because then they said they weren't in the country, although what they neglected to realize is that they were in New Zealand airspace, and they're under international law, they were, in fact, in New Zealand. But they count everybody, tourists and people just visiting on any other temporary thing, everybody, whether they're a citizen, permanent resident, tourist, whatever, it doesn't matter. And so everybody fills out a form, and then there's a dwelling form that covers the entire household as well. And that is quite a long form. And that's where they ask some of the more detailed questions about internet usage and telephones, the number of televisions and stuff like that. And so when you see some of this data on Statistics New Zealand, that's where it comes from by and large. Now, finally, on Tuesday at 8 p.m., we are going to have a special Pride Information Info live cast on Pride 48, and we'll do that every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time up until the event, mainly to share information with the participants, but also listeners may find something interesting from time to time. The chat room, of course, will be usable for anybody who wants to ask questions or offer suggestions or what have you. So that will be 8 p.m. Tuesday Eastern Daylight Time, which is tomorrow as I'm recording. And you may have noticed that I ran a commercial for Too Political at the end of the last episode. It's because I was a little bit under half an hour, and I thought, why not? Because Too Political isn't running any promos. And then, too, when I posted the last Too Political, I tacked on an Amarin's podcast commercial at the end of it. Promo, sorry. Oh, God, there's a plane overhead now. Because I thought I might as well take advantage of that audience. And so if there are any new listeners who have come to this podcast through Pride 48, either listening to it on the stream or what have you, welcome. By all means, ask a question, make a comment, whatever you want to do. Have a look around. But that's it for today. I'll be back later this week with another episode. And, of course, tomorrow, Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Pride 48. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amarin's Podcast at amarinspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amarinspodcast.com. Or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.